Well, thank you, everyone, especially for coming back during the workday. I'm not sure how many of you are playing hooky from jobs today, but thank you for coming back. And I'm happy to give, just before I begin my main presentation for the morning, a little background on Bishop Barron's Word on Fire Institute, because I am really excited to be a part of it. Now, Bishop Barron is kind of a marvel of evangelization. He's the producer of the Catholicism, both book and TV series that aired on PBS, which is not specifically a Catholic channel. And I think part of what makes him such a good evangelist is that when he thinks about how to welcome people into the faith, he's really someone who's led by beauty and delight, that you can always feel his enthusiasm for whatever he's sharing, and it draws other people in, even if they, you know, don't think of themselves as seeking to be converted. And so what he started is a new program called the Word on Fire Institute, which you can find at wordonfire.institute, which is really just a series of online classes and an online community for Catholics who want really to be able to evangelize better. And I'll say frankly, I think everyone's somewhat prepared to evangelize as long as we're open to the Holy Spirit. But I think what holds us back is, you know, fear or uncertainty or past troubles in evangelization, which are all real barriers to feeling, you know, comfortable sharing our faith in a way that we think will be fruitful. And so a lot of the focus of the Word on Fire Institute is to give people more tools and more confidence to evangelize so that you have interesting material. Bishop Barron's first course is already up, and it's on the theologian von Balthasar, who he loves. And I'll be doing a course that's kind of related to what I'm going to speak about this morning, about how to increase the hospitality you already offer in your own home. And I think it's really lovely, and the classes have started, but it's not too late to join. They kind of will keep coming out. And there's just already kind of a rollicking community in the forums associated with it, with a lot of people sharing book recommendations and prayer requests, which I think is lovely. What I'd like to talk to you about today is what I'm going to be teaching about for the first of two classes I'll be teaching for Word on Fire, which is, you know, how do we evangelize through hospitality? How do we open up our homes, open up our lives, open up our prayers to others? And as a convert, I told, you know, folks that were here last night, this was incredibly important for me because I needed people to open their lives and their hearts to me to help tutor me in how to be Catholic. Oh, and one of the things I found kind of really helpful about the church as I was joining was just the witnesses of the saints and just the tremendously varied witnesses of the saints. I found this to be, you know, one of the marks of the truth of Catholicism, that when we ask people to be like Christ, you know, each of us created small, we almost act like facets of a diamond refracting a part of the light of Christ. So we have saints who are renowned for their virginity or for their family life or for, you know, the wars they led or for their pacifism, that we kind of see the generosity of Christ thrown into sharp relief in kind of small slices of a human life. You know, and I loved this because G.K. Chesterton, who you now already know I like, mentioned his delight in, you know, the strong and varied examples of the saints by saying, you know, and he was looking specifically at the different examples of virginity and family life. And he says, the church has always kept them side by side, like two strong colors, red and white, like the red and white upon the shield of St. George. It has always had a healthy hatred of pink. And I think, you know, part of the way I want to start is just by talking about the varied vocations in the church, you know, that are open to us and kind of illuminate different parts of the church's teaching. So, you know, I think I can guess from having talked to some of you, but I imagine, raise your hand here if you've ever considered, whether or not you are married, considered the vocation of marriage for yourself, right? You know, one of the fewer than I think are very shy hand raisers here. You know, and who here has ever, again, regardless of whether you wound it up, you know, spent some time thinking about whether you were called to the priesthood or consecrated religious life? I went on a really lovely retreat with the Dominican Sisters of Nashville, but I was already dating my husband now at the time. So, you know, when I went to the vocation store, I'm like, well, I really hope I'm not supposed to be a nun, because I want to marry my boyfriend. But I'm really glad I went. You know, and who here has ever tried to discern a calling to the life of a stylite, one of the more historical vocations of the church? No? Yeah, it's not a popular vocation now, and perhaps explaining it will make it clear why. You know, the stylites were a kind of hermit, but instead of going out to the desert or being enclosed within walls, the stylites would sit on top of, like, platforms on large structures, you know, and kind of just give their life over to God, and the way the Desert Fathers did in the early church, by kind of, you know, removing all distractions and consecrating themselves to sustained prayer, and the way cloistered nuns do also, but kind of in a stranger, more unexpected public way. And of course, because they were doing this, you know, people would go, why is that man living on a platform giving his whole life to God? He must be very holy. We should stand at the bottom of his platform and yell our questions up to him, which is, like, very frustrating for the stylites. You know, and it's the kind of vocation that people weren't encouraged to just kind of take on a whim, right? Because like being a cloistered religious or a desert hermit, you know, it's a challenging, exhausting life. Monks who wanted to become desert hermits in the early church needed the permission of their monastic superior because, you know, they needed to kind of have their sea legs in prayer before they were allowed to do something this extreme. Their monastic superior had to be sure that they had a healthy, vibrant prayer life, that they were good at discernment, and they would be kind of safe on their own. Which makes it weird that a lot of people, without ever discerning the life of a stylite or actively choosing the life of a stylite, and certainly without the permission of a spiritual advisor, can find themselves accidentally living the life of a stylite, just instead of in a platform, you know, perhaps in an apartment building or, you know, in their first home out of college, where they're still kind of disconnected from a larger community in prayer, still living alone, just kind of nakedly with God, but without any of the preparation that would have been important for living that way. So a lot of what motivated my own interest in hospitality and community was, first of all, the way my friends leapt to my defense, converting into a little like shooting off a flare gun, right, where everyone comes and tells you about who they want your confirmation saint to be, among other things. But where my friends kind of leapt to my defense because they were sure, like, I wasn't ready to just be a Christian alone without support and without, you know, love and without active prayer and prayer that's shared between us. But I think for a lot of Catholics, they can wind up in a vulnerable period of their life, particularly during and after college, but at any point after a move, after a job transition, where we wind up uprooted from the families and communities that have sustained us, or even stay in one place and find that some of our structures are crumbling away, and find that we've accidentally taken on the vocation of a stylite, again, without the preparation that that demanding vocation needs. So what's been interesting to me is what I can do and what we can do to kind of counteract that pull. Because if you ask what's pulling us apart, frustratingly for me, there's really not just one enemy or one, you know, adversary to be defeated that makes us lonely or disconnected. You know, I think it's a combination of many things, you know, everything from what you might hear more often, you know, kind of the challenges to Christianity and public life, but also things kind of as boring as zoning, right? Where I've had friends who would like to live with other friends, but it can get complicated in different communities where it can be illegal to have too many people who aren't related living together. So kind of the relationships that were an unusual part of everyday life, right? Of, you know, oh, you know, well, this is our house, like, and our grandparents are living with us, or, you know, oh, we just have this friend who's, she's not married, so she just lives in our basement and is an aunt to all of our children. You know, a way of making people part of your family, especially people who haven't found families of their own or, you know, who have wound up alone through death or bereavement, can sometimes even be illegal depending on the zoning restrictions of your neighborhood. There are so many small things pulling us apart. We have to do many small things to pull ourselves back together. And part of the way I got particularly interested in this and found a group of people who were interested in this project was because of a lot of discussion that was kind of sparked by the writer Rod Dreher's discussion of the Benedict option. And briefly, you know, because there are kind of a number of conflicting definitions of what this means, the one I like is one that the New York Times columnist Ross Douthat came up with for what is the Benedict option, what is Rod Dreher calling for. And he said it's a ratchet effect. You know, it's the process of taking one step deeper into community and prayer from wherever you are. It's not, you know, okay, the one way to live the Benedict option is to form a commune, create a school, like, take over an apartment building if you're in New York and just fill it with Catholics and, like, knock out one floor and build a chapel. I think that would be awesome. I do not have the money to do that in New York. But he said, you know, it's not one goal. It's looking at where you are and taking one step closer to God with others. That's the goal. And I like that because it means you can really, it's accessible to everyone. You know, it's a calling for everyone. And the focus of my book, Building the Benedict Option, is about ways you can create thicker Christian community over the timescale of the next 2 weeks to 2 months. So wherever you are, without any kind of, I definitely can't do that until I move, until I buy a house, wherever you are, something. And I kind of organized people to start talking about this. You know, and there were a couple questions that I think we'll return to in the breakout session, but I want to talk about how they've been helpful focuses for me about how to create hospitality. And one of the simplest was, what do I do alone that I could do with other people? And for me, like, the answer to this can be things that are good or things that are difficult. You know, where one of the simplest things I do alone that I really long to do more with other people is singing. And it was something where when we started talking about this, luckily a lot of my friends kind of had the same inclination. Because for me, singing happens mostly in my shower at home and at Mass. Though at Mass, I am not picking the songs. So there are a lot of hymns that I love that I rarely sing with anyone else. You know, and I've tried even just singing them more with my husband at home. But for that, you know, and especially before I was married and before I can kind of lean on the fact of my marriage to go, like, Alexi, I am dying to sing Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. Come sing it with me, right? Like, where when I lived more by myself or lived with non-Christian roommates, that wasn't a request I felt I could make, or wasn't someone I felt like I had any clear person I could ask to sing with me. You know, and singing is such a natural way of being together, but kind of, again, limited in where we do it. There's a writer called Ray Oldenburg who writes about the evaporation of communal space and just communal joy. And one of the things he says, which I'll paraphrase here, is just, you know, he contrasts the fact that people think it's normal. He was writing before the age of earbuds, right? But that it's normal for a young man to walk down the street listening to his radio on his shoulder. He goes, but let him make music of his own. Like, let him sing. And then he's a crazy person, right? And he says, like, people, you know, used to gather around in, you know, pubs and all sing together. You know, we still see this sometimes in soccer culture or other moments of, like, European ebullience. He goes, but now he's expected to content himself with a little moderate singing in the shower. So this is one of the things where it's part of how I pray. St. Augustine says, he who sings prays twice. But it was never happening naturally, and all the natural things that had supported it had fallen away. And a friend of mine who's more musically talented than I am and has a piano generously had a group of us over to her house and just said, send me what hymns you love and I'll find music and we'll sing them together. You know, and it's that kind of simple generosity that I'm most interested in, not setting up an institution of how will we sing by rota all the time on alternate Tuesdays, how will we make this last forever, which I think intimidates folks past the point of being able to start something. I think our gift as lay people is that we're not in charge of planning the parish calendar for the next, like, 2 years. We're allowed to do something good once, like, and simply the fact of offering it is enough. You know, my friend Sarah had us all over to sing. You know, and that was really the only time that year we did that one time, but it made it easier to ask anyone else to sing any other time without a formal invitation. It was just a simple good thing that I had for myself but never got to share, and I just said, what would it take to do this with others? But I also kind of formed one event around something that wasn't something like song, something I loved, something I found nourishing. I thought of one thing I hated that maybe it would be better to do with others. I've held a number of jobs already, and I'm not that old, but I hate changing jobs. I hate applying for jobs. I hate writing cover letters that I send off into the ether that nobody replies to. And because I've worked in writing, that meant I've spent some time in my life applying for jobs that are unpaid, which like is the most depressing thing. Because that means when I write a cover letter and a resume and I send it to someone asking them if they'd consider hiring me for no money to work for them, and then they never even call. They haven't just said like, well, you know, given our options, we chose not to hire you for this amount of money. They went like, you know what? Like, your work is worth less than no money for us. We wouldn't take it for free. And not only wouldn't we not like make the final call to take it for free, we're not even interested in checking if we want your money, your work for free, right? So I would always, when I applied for jobs, like have this miasma of despair that crept over me. You know, even when I was applying for jobs I ultimately got, because obviously I don't know that when I'm writing the cover letter, it feels the same as every application I send out that just feels like a hailstorm of worthlessness. You know, and at the time in DC, I was at this point, like, had a job and was sticking with it for a bit, but I had a couple friends who were changing jobs who had asked me to pray for them, and I was doing it, but I felt like that wasn't enough, especially because, and I found this a lot kind of in moments of spiritual warfare and spiritual attack, like the idea that I was worthless felt very true while I was applying for jobs. The idea that my friend Yvonne was worthless when he was applying for jobs was obviously false, right? To me, that I could see clearly. And I've always even found it helpful, like, to when I feel kind of tempted by despair or hopelessness, just to remember how angry I get when any of my friends feel that way. And, you know, even if I can't pray for myself in that moment of sorrow, to pray for them, right? So that even an attack, you know, is a prompting to prayer. The harder the devil comes at me, like, the more, if I can't stand up for myself, I'll stand up for my friends. So, kind of motivated by that, not wanting just to pray for my friend Yvonne and others, but really wanting to do something for and with them, I offered to have a job applications night at my house. And my plan was, folks would come over to my house, we would pray evening office together, people would work on job applications while I made dinner, we would eat dinner, people would work on job applications for a bit, like, we would have a skillet cookie, which is, like, what it sounds like. It is a cookie the size of a skillet. It's like my go-to, there are guests in my house, what will I do? Like, no one is unhappy with a cookie the size of a skillet. We'd have the skillet cookie, we'd like do one last round of work, we'd pray night office, and then folks would head home. And the reason I wanted to do it is because I thought, you know, all those temptations to despair, to not really believing in ourselves as the beloved children of God, those lies are harder to believe when we're surrounded by other people who love us, right? When we wrap that whole work in prayer through the divine office at the beginning and end of the night, so that almost all the difficult work is just like a pause in the middle of prayer, and that simply our physical presence was a testimony against, you know, the satanic lies that we are nothing. This is one of my favorite events I've thrown. You know, and I've had kind of a range of ways I've opened my house, some of which were much bigger. I've had 30 people in an apartment. And at this night, I had just 3 people over, but they were the 3 people who I most wanted to be with in the middle of this difficult time. So So I think kind of that question of what do I do alone that I could do with other people is very fruitful in those two branches. What's good to share that I'm not getting the opportunity to share? And what's dangerous to do alone, where I can help take care of other people or ask them to take care of me by, you know, bringing us together? You know, and in neither of these events did I do anything very complicated about hospitality. There was no fine china. I own no fine china. You know, simply the fact of sharing a meal was enough to take care of each other. One of the other questions I found really helpful was, you know, what do I do in private that I could do in public? And the reason this felt fruitful to me is because, you know, I was kind of, especially as a convert, I had no habit of making space for God in my life. You know, my husband's a convert also, but he's a convert from Anglicanism, which is a lot closer to Catholicism than atheism. And I've been so richly, you know, fed by his own habits of prayer that began before he was part of the Catholic Church, by his family. His whole family came over together, right? But his family brought him up to love God and to make space for God in his life from the beginning. And he's an example to me in that. But I don't have that background or have that experience. So for me, kind of figuring out how and when to pray was kind of a, okay, what will I now choose to give God of my life? He who has given me my whole life and my whole day, which parts will I pick for him? And what that often led me to by default was kind of, again, that same habit, almost as with saying, of, all right, well, I definitely pray at Mass, you know, and I pray in my apartment. You know, and those are kind of the two places I talk to God. And it's not a bad start, but it's certainly not the fullness of truth. God is speaking to me at all times. It's just kind of almost as though, you know, only at church and only in my house initially was I bothering to pick up the phone and, like, speak back. And so I was kind of interested in what it would take for me to be able to feel comfortable praying anywhere else, to reclaim the rest of my life for God. And I was especially nervous at the beginning where, you know, I've said grace in bathrooms before dinner rather than kind of suddenly, well, everyone, guess who's Catholic now, right? But that balance was difficult for me. And one thing that made it easier is the fact that I've lived in Washington, D.C. and New York, where it's very hard for me to be the strangest thing anyone sees during the day. It's maybe a little different out here in Lake Jackson. But it made it a lot easier for me to consider, you know, switching from what I'd been doing initially, which was praying the rosary on the subway sometimes by counting fingers on my hand in a, like, extremely subtle, quiet way, to praying the rosary on the subway by taking my rosary out of my bag and literally praying with it. And to be honest, this wasn't something I really started as a mode of evangelism. If anything, it felt like it made evangelism harder, because if I'm wearing a cross, praying the rosary, I probably can't throw elbows to get onto the subway. Because if you're going to see me a second later pull out my rosary after I, like, shove my way in front of you, it kind of put more of my life on display as a witness of what Christian life looks like than felt fair, but was truer. But I mostly wanted to pray the rosary on the subway just so that when I have the impulse to pray, when the Holy Spirit prompts me to pray, I'm never like, oh, I can't right now. This isn't a place for prayer. This is the subway. This is the sidewalk. This is, you know, an airplane. You can't pray on airplanes. You're too high up, right? Like, whatever the strange feeling was, it said, like, later, God, I'll talk to you later. But it has been a blessing for me to pray in public at other times. You know, I've never really gotten a bad response to silent prayer that's just visibly prayer when I've been out and about in the world. Like, I've had, like, a couple, you know, I was eating dinner in a restaurant once, like, tell me they were happy they saw me say grace before a meal, who were at the next table over. And recently, when I was on my way to New Haven for a different speaking engagement, you know, I was praying the rosary on, I was praying on the rosary, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, on my way up. And the man in the seat across from me turned out to also be Catholic. You know, said he was surprised to see someone praying physically with the rosary. And then when we talked, asked me to pray for him because he was undergoing treatment for leukemia. And I think there are a lot of ways in which just simply praying for ourselves without an explicit goal of evangelization, without asking explicitly anyone to join us, kind of makes us more like the Dominican friars who drew my attention by making us publicly, visibly Catholic in a way that someone who's been looking for someone to pray for them may know that we could be that person. So taking what I do privately and making it spill out into the rest of the world so that it is accessible to others, and to remind myself that God is always accessible to me. Now, kind of, I said I had two prongs to the first question for what you do alone that you could do with others, the good things and the bad things. And I kind of have two secret prongs for this one. And they're like the reasonable things and the crazy things. And I've talked about the reasonable ones, which are just saying grace, like praying the rosary. Since I live in New York City now, I feel like I have more room to do the wackier things. And some of these things are things that even my parish does that I can participate in. My parish does processions, including once with a brass band, which was like surprising to me. But what my husband calls them, he says that processions are invasions of beauty into the world. And I love that, that we have so many treasures in our church and so many people in the world who don't realize, you know, having never crossed the threshold, that they might long for what we have. That processions kind of sponsored by a parish are a way of letting the bounty God has given us spill over into the world so that it can reach the people who don't realize what they're hungry for. And it's an enormous blessing for me that my parish does do a couple processions a year, and I love participating in them. But it's kind of not enough processions for me. So last year, well, this past year, you know, the Monday after Pentecost was the first ever feast of Mary, Mother of the Church, a new Marian feast instituted by Pope Francis. It was really exciting for me because since I'm a convert, I've celebrated a lot of feasts for the first time, but it's never been that everyone else is also celebrating it for the first time together. So my husband and I invited a bunch of Catholic friends over for dinner to celebrate the feast. And we're like, guys, it's the first time this feast is ever happening. We get to decide like how we want to celebrate it. How would you feel about like praying the rosary as a group, like going around our neighborhood first and then having dinner? Everyone's like, yeah, okay, that sounds fine. Like, how would you feel about doing it while wearing like printed out images of paintings of Mary around our necks? And like our friends are weird, so like they mostly said, sure, okay. And the reason I want to do this is not just because I'm a like generally outrageous person, but because I guess the thing that often makes me feel most hesitant about praying in public is not being sure how other people will receive it, especially at times when folks may have had difficult experiences with Catholicism, or even, you know, from my own experience as an atheist, kind of being worried that when people prayed near me and knew I was an atheist, they were praying against me, right? Like, and so I wanted something that made it clear, like, we weren't out there praying a rosary being like, God, smite this whole neighborhood, you know? which really felt possible to me before I was Christian. I wanted to be able to carry with us the reason for our joy and the reason for our hope. And I think art is an invitation into that. And again, where the variety of images people carried are a testament to how we know Mary, right? Where we had, you know, an image of the Annunciation that someone had, an image of the Holy Family. I had an image of Our Lady of Sorrows, where we're kind of showing the full range of what we see when we look at kind of a perfect woman's life. And that it's more vivid and like astounding than people assume. You know, my husband kind of pointed out, walking through New York City, you know, to think about all the images of women that were already present on the street that day in advertisements, you know, the semi-pornographic, like, much more similar each to the other, even though they're of different women, than the images we were carrying. To think about what people had seen all day of what women were, and then to think about the images we were carrying with us as an answer or a fuller exploration of the question. And this wasn't something where anyone stopped us and went like, I wish to become Catholic today, right? But you know, I think it gave all of us more room to certainly feel comfortable praying the rosary quietly on ourselves with no signs, ever. And just to remind ourselves that, you know, my whole neighborhood belongs to God. You know, properly speaking, all of this is for him. Like, it's always a good place to pray the rosary, and it's always a good place for images of Mary. And today's the day that we're reminding ourselves in the neighborhood of that fact. That's kind of, that's, to be honest, like, the one of the wildest things I've done. Though sometimes the like, medium place on the spectrum is just doing events that I could do in my own home in public so that someone else can stop us or ask us questions if they want to. And, you know, often a lot less showy than the Marian procession with rosaries and art. But two of the things we've done just in parks rather than in living rooms have been reading the play A Man for All Seasons on the feast of St. Thomas More, where we just went out to a park that's big enough that no one's kind of forced to listen to us read the play if they don't want to, but got together with a group of friends and just read the play aloud, enjoyed the play, and if anyone wanted to ask, we'd be happy to say, we're doing it because it's a feast day. Like, it's the feast of St. Thomas More. Feel free to come join in. Do you want one of the small parts? On a different day, we had kind of a picnic of for All Saints, though not exactly on the Feast of All Saints because people were busy. But, you know, just kind of a picnic where people could come and tell stories about their favorite saints and share them with each other. Easy to do in my house, but closed off if we did it there. In a park, anyone could join us. We made like a tiny little sign that said All Saints Picnic. But even people sitting nearby might overhear something that interested them without us stopping them or interrupting them. I'll be honest, I haven't gotten, you know, any really startling responses to some of my public Catholic events. But one of the reasons I have faith in this approach is because I have gotten, you know, unusual responses to other things I've taken from private to public. When I lived in Washington, D.C., I used to host a series of debates in my living room for my friends, since, as you heard last night, I came out of this debate background. And even though we'd go up for alumni events, we kind of still wanted to do this all the time. But I lived in an apartment building that had a really large roof. So when it was nice out, we'd go up and do the debates up there. And after we'd done this a couple of times, one of the days I was up there and this woman comes up to me and she goes, are you guys, we're setting up, right? Like, and I'm holding a gavel. And she goes, are you the debate group that meets up here? And I'm like, yes. Like, figuring her next comment is like, keep it down, or like, what is with you people, right? She goes, you know, my son is, you know, 13 and we homeschool. Like, would it be okay if he sat nearby where he could eavesdrop? Because we saw you up here once and he was really interested. So if he just sat nearby and like kind of didn't make a fuss or anything, could he kind of listen in? And I'm like, no, no, absolutely not. Like, he should sit with us. Like, he shouldn't sit in like a little annex, right? He can sit with us and he can ask questions or give a speech if he wants to. That's fine, right? And so he did. And because, you know, he was able to find us, he lived in the building, he started coming to all the debates whenever he was free, including the ones in my living room. You know, and everyone got a little more careful with the language they used on the debate floor, which to me was a selling point, right? But, you know, he'd lived in our building and he'd had no way to find us, even though we lived only a couple floors apart, except that we moved things out of the living room and into a place where he could see and ask to be part of it. You know, and he stuck with our debate group until his family moved, right? And we all loved him, right? And it was a gift to us, too, the people who kind of come into your life by happenstance, because aside from this boy, like all of us like young professionals in our 20s in DC, we saw no teenagers. There were no teenagers who were part of our lives. Certainly none of us 20-somethings had teenagers of our own yet. But it was so often the case that families just moved in different circles than we did, that when we solely reached out to the people we knew who it might occur to us to invite to closed events in our homes, we would never have seen anyone his age. It was by taking the private public that we had the chance, really, for the Holy Spirit to bring other people to us. So the one other thing I want to talk about as kind of a prompt here is, you know, something that really struck me when I had my initial gathering with folks. When I brought people together to talk about how can we build community, and we kind of did it in two phases. we talked about, you know, what do we want in the abstract and what do we want ever? And I think that's kind of a fruitful a question, but it can be distracting because what you ask for are things that are interesting but clearly not possible now. And it takes all the wind out of our sails when it's like, well, one day in the future, it'd be nice if when more of us are married and have kids, we live in a town and homeschool together, like later, that has no relevance for us at this moment, right? So I made sure that the last like half hour to 45 minutes of our time together was focused on what my book is focused on, like the next 2 weeks to 2 months. And I asked folks kind of, you know, what do we want? What do people need here? And people talked about some of the things I've talked about singing, about, you know, seeing children was a desire that my friends had, right? And I talked about what do we have to offer each other? And people kind of named a range of things. You know, Sarah had her piano. One to two people had cars, because we lived in a city and very few people had cars. Some folks had flexible work schedules, which made it easier to visit someone who was sick without having to get time off, right? And I thought I had something like pretty clever as a twist on what we had to offer each other. And like, well, you know, one other thing is that, you know, Annalie here is like, as we all know, because you could really see it, like super pregnant. And that's a big gift to our group, not just because that means there will be a baby here soon and people have expressed their longing just to live a normal human life that has babies in it, right? Which again, weirdly out of reach. But because Annalie's already part of our group, we're not going to design all of our events and all of our time together in a way that excludes parents. You know, she can't do and won't do events that kind of start at 9 and end at 11. And because we have parents here from the beginning, we're not going to accidentally design our social group in a way that excludes parents. So then, like, the first parent we meet will find that we've kind of built our life in a way that they can't join. So Annalie has a constraint that's a gift to all of us. That's kind of like, that's very clever. I bet I blew everyone's minds there, right? You know, and then one person goes, well, like if we're going to talk about limits and constraints as a thing we can offer, I'm an alcoholic. And if there's anyone here who's kind of having struggles with alcohol, you know, they can talk to me. That's something I have for the group. And then one of my friends mentioned that she was in recovery from anorexia. You know, and especially given the church's seasons of fasting, like wanted people to know that if this posed a danger or a hardship to them, that she could talk to them about it and would pray with them about it. And another person talked about their experiences with depression. And then another. And some of these stories I'd known before we gathered, but not all of them. And so I had friends who, as we gathered together with folks in the room who were strangers to each of the people who was kind of laying themselves bare, took the crosses of their life, took the hardest things they'd endured and said, this is my gift to the group. This is what I have to offer. And I think that's our most encouraging witness to hospitality. You know, whether we're opening our house in a simple way, just having folks over for a saint's day you particularly love and praying a small prayer for that saint, or whether you're offering the thorn in your side, that everything God gives us, he gives us to share. And we never need to be afraid that we don't have something to offer to others as a gift. Because my friends took their wounds and invited us in. Thank you.